Well, I guess we can get started. The session today that we listed is, well, I'm not sure how you had it listed. I had it listed as Holden Community Develops, and I think it's basically the same as what you had. I think community is probably one of the hardest things to understand, and I guess personally I don't think you can create community. I think community happens, and at Holden I think it, again, it was another one of those things where there wasn't a committee that said we want to establish a community because community is important to you know, the future of the church, the future of society, and so forth. But it, you know, it happened, and again, I'm not a student of community, but I guess I would say that from my experience, that community is more circumstance than it is anything else. And in fact, it's interesting that Holden, and I think I mentioned one in the previous sessions, that Holden tried to duplicate the Holden experience. And one of the attempts was to create it down at 25 Mile Creek, where the bed and breakfast is now. In fact, that's how the bed and breakfast got started. It wasn't, again, designed for a bed and breakfast. It was designed as a satellite community of Holden, and they were going to establish a small group of people down there that would basically live in the house down there and also do gardening. And at one point, even before that, there was a lot of discussion, serious discussion by the board about trying to purchase a small farm someplace in north central Washington or south of that, where it would be not a harsh climate but a good climate for growing like truck farms and so forth. And because we used a lot of food up here, and the idea of a community that would then exist to supply, you know, at least part of the food for Holden Village and be a satellite community was attractive. But, you know, that didn't go. And then the Tekoa, I think, was the, yeah, that, and Larry, I get a nod from Larry because he's so. I couldn't think of it first, and I was almost going to ask you, and then I thought of it. But Tekoa was the name of the community, and Joe Oinas, I think, he was a volunteer up here. He was also, I think he was a pastor at the time, an ordained pastor. He went down to establish this little community down there, and I think they were there for a year or two, I don't recall, but it just never took hold. Just sort of jokingly, I told him that, you know, what they need if they want to establish a community down there is find a resident monk. And because I think that, for one thing, a community needs you know, some continuous presence of somebody. You know, and it doesn't have to be a special person necessarily, but I think in some of the ancient communities it was sort of like that. There was a resident monk, and you know, the resident monk might be 80 years old but was still there and probably had been there for 50 years and provided some of the discipline and so forth. So anyway, a community at Holden is you know, is very special, and it's special now, and it was special then. Now I think that, you know, people, you know, talk more about community. Back at the beginning, we didn't talk about community. It was just a sort of the day-to-day operation. But I think one reason that community happened here is that there was in a minor sense, sort of a sense of survival. I mean, we were remote, and we understood that. I don't recall that we ever talked a lot about the remoteness and the dangers. I mean, we had our fire drills. We knew we could contact a helicopter. We didn't know whether a helicopter would come, but we knew we could contact one. And during those first 20 years, it was amazing because, I mean, things are much better organized now than it was in those first 20 years. But there were no deaths during that time. I think since that time, in the last 30 years or 36 years, there have been a couple of deaths up here. Maybe, I don't remember if it's right in the village or if they were, you know, associated with people a little bit on the trail in the wilderness. But at that time, even though it was very remote, we had minimal communications, we had minimal, you know, medical potential, that we were very fortunate that there were no deaths at the time. But I think survival is one of those things that helps create community. That one of the interesting things here is that you don't have an opportunity to drive to Chelan for an evening meal or to go to the movies or to do something. Whereas in a lot of retreat centers and a lot of conference centers, you always have that option. So you might be a part of a community for most of the day, but then you decide, well, let's go into the you know, the restaurant and have a meal, or go into town and shop. Some people really love to shop. But once you're here, there is no option. And I think that was another thing that helped, you know, community to be created, not intentionally, but just because that's what happens when you're together as a group. You know, you eat together, you sing together, you pray together, you work together, you are innovative together, and community happens, but I don't think you can plan it. And I think the other thing that happens with you know, in a place like Holden and for community is that having minimum controls. You know, as I mentioned before, that initially there were just two of us, Carol Hinderly and myself, were the only two sort of management people. We were the only paid people to be here, and in a sense, to make sure that the community or the village functioned. But everybody else, and a high percentage of the people here at that time were volunteers. Now, oftentimes the guests outnumber the volunteers, but the volunteers in the community certainly outnumbered the number of people. I mean, nobody received stipends. As I mentioned, it was just the two of us, plus there were maybe five others that were getting small salaries or stipends. But everybody else was strictly volunteer. They received no money to arrive here. They didn't get a boat ticket. They didn't have any insurance from the village. They were strictly on their own. And it's amazing now that you'd think that even people came up under those circumstances. But they did. They, you know, as I say, we had many more volunteer applications than we could take, because people, I guess, they didn't worry about it. They, and maybe that's part of what community is too, is you know, you're together, you find comfort within a group, you find safety within a group, none of those things are planned. We didn't have any, you know, meetings, you know, saying, well, who's going to provide safety today? It was just that we were here together. We were here as firefighters together. Sometimes we had a doctor in the community that volunteered his or her time. Oftentimes we had a nurse, but not always. There were times when we didn't have any medical personnel up here, and we didn't really, I guess, worry about it, because there was no option. We did have a radio system when we first opened the village in the wintertime. That was at least what I thought was sort of a necessity, that we have some emergency communications. And we contacted the Chelan County Sheriff's Department to see once it was possible to have, you know, some contact, direct contact with the Sheriff's Department in Wenatchee, just for emergencies. And so they were very, I mean, they were wonderful. They came right up with their own sheriff's boat, and they brought along the communications person from Central Communication, and they spent 3 or 4 hours here with their test equipment, and basically concluded that no, you can't have any communications out of here. but they said, we're going to try one more thing before we go down lake. We'll take the boat up to Stehekin, and I think they left something here, or no, I guess Stehekin already had a radio system that went to the Sheriff's Department, so they knew that they could get from Stehekin, from the general store there. Old Harry Buckner, who's long gone, was the owner proprietor. He was the postmaster of Stehekin, and he was also the proprietor of the general store. And that he had a sheriff's radio in the store, and he could call the sheriff's department directly. So they made contact with Harry and to establish the fact that we could get from here to Stehekin. And so that meant that even though we couldn't get direct, we could get to Harry, who was only there 8 hours a day, and not in the wintertime, not every day. but at least we had contact then, so we could make emergency phone calls if we needed it. And I think the second year we were up here in the wintertime, we added, and I don't remember, I think the sheriff covered the expense of it. We paid for the radio, by the way, that we purchased the radio that then we had permission to be on the frequency with the sheriff's department. But they put a alarm buzzer up at the store in Stehekin, and so that if we had an emergency, you know, like during the night when nobody was at the store or at the post office, or during the winter again on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday when the boat wasn't running, then we could activate the buzzer on the radio and it would send out a loud, you know, horn sound in Stehekin, and hopefully somebody would hear it. Because Harry Buckner lived up the valley, I don't know, 5-6 miles, so he wasn't going to hear it, but there always seemed to be some people that were in residence right in Stehekin, and so it was not a sure bet, but it was at least it was better than nothing. And again, we were able to get by with that. And we actually tried citizen band radios before at about the same time, because we thought with the snowmobile that, you know, if something happened on the way down or something, that maybe a citizen band radio would make contact, so we'd have some contact. And so we bought citizen band radio. And our first test indicated that we could get down to not quite 10 mile before we lost the signal. so obviously that wasn't going to do us any good. And years later, a fellow by the name of Larry Penberthy, who was an engineer, in fact, either owned or operated a glass, I don't know if you say factory or purification, or anyway, they made glass in Seattle, and he was very much involved in mountaineering, and he got really mad at Recreation Equipment Co-op, the famous Recreation Equipment Incorporated, I guess. And anyway, he got really mad at them because he claimed that they were putting out inferior, or they were selling inferior equipment for climbing, and it was dangerous. And so he started his own company. It was called Mountain Research Institute, I think it was MSI. And so he started manufacturing very high-grade climbing equipment. And I'm getting around to the radios again, I think. But anyway, he started coming up here because one thing he was interested in was using citizens band radios for mountain rescue. And so every Labor Day for, you know, like 4 years, he came up here with a small crew and they attempted to climb Bonanza. And of course, that time of year is, you know, a terrible time to try to climb, at least at that. Now, we've had some nice weather, but typically over Labor Day, it was rainy, it was cold. We had the first snow on the mountains oftentimes. And invariably, they got weathered off the mountain. But again, I would have the base station down here, and he would have portable radios as they started their trek up Bonanza. And, you know, they would get to the ballpark, and, you know, there was no radio contact. I think he also decided that radio, or that type of communication just wasn't worth it. But again, the communication, I mean, just for safety's sake, because we did have, you know, lots of people coming up here, and so it's necessary to have a few things and at least be, you know, somewhat safe when you're dealing with the public, you're dealing with young people, and also you're dealing with a lot of lack of controls, and that's I think the other thing that helps create community. I mean, it's both a detrimental part, but it's also a potential, I think, allows community to exist, is if you don't have so many rules, and sheets of this and sheets of that indicate when you can do something, when you can't do something. And in those days, we, you know, basically didn't have any rule. I mean, the only rule, in fact, we made a point of saying the only rule we have up here is that you attend Vespers, evening Vespers. And that was basically about it. And I think, especially thinking back on it, that that was one of the reasons why I think such an intense community was possible to develop up here, is because the volunteers who were here, you know, had the freedom of basically saying what they wanted to say, write what they wanted to write. As long as they were, you know, doing the work as a volunteer and so forth, they had a lot of freedom. So things were very innovative. If they wanted to do something, chances are they never asked. And we didn't require it, which was maybe just a lack of management expertise. If we were knew what we were doing, maybe we would have made rules. But fortunately, you know, Carol was a pastor, I was an engineer, and not all engineers, I mean, some engineers like rules, but I guess I never thought rules were that good. But anyway, so there was a lot of innovation that took place, and, you know, in the wood shop. Or one example was, you know, again, I was saying that I was sort of sorry that, I'm not going to play with it.
No.
One of the sad things is that the mill building is no longer there, with all the iron and the metal and so forth that used to be the source of not only maintenance, but also artwork. Terry Saturn, many of you know the name if you don't know Terry personally, and he started, I mean, he was a genius in so many ways. He was one of the unique people that came to Holden. His father was a very famous choral conductor at Augsburg in Minneapolis, but he was more into things with his hands and with his eyes. He was a very visual person. He came up here the first two times with the Augsburg theater group, and I'm not sure if he was actually in the theater group or if he did the sets. I think because later he was professionally in that field of designing sets for even the Seattle Repertory Theater and so forth. He got a very good job there. He's retired now. But he decided to try art welding, and he didn't know how to weld, but he went up, and he didn't ask me, and maybe he asked the mechanic, or maybe the mechanic who did know how to weld, you know, helped him a little bit, but he learned to weld, and I think it's probably still someplace here. The dancing servant became sort of a symbol of Holden Village, and that was one of Terry Saturn's art welding projects. And so he, you know, art welding got started up here, and not only did we have the weaving and the pottery and the other things that we had as far as art opportunities, but for a while they even had art welding, and Terry would teach people art welding, and it was sort of like the pottery shop. I always, you know, kidded people, because if you take pottery at the university or at a school, you know, the first semester is learning how ceramics stick together, you know, and then maybe the second semester you get to do something with your hands, and then maybe the wheel comes in the third or fourth semester. I'm just making this up, but here, you know, somebody would come to the pottery shop, and the first hour they could sit down at the wheel, and some people discovered that they were natural at this. And there are professional potters. In fact, there's one in Arizona that was one of the potters up here that first just sat down and discovered that he had a knack for making things with the pottery wheel. So again, that was a unique thing about Holden, is that it was sort of like a university, but you could skip a lot of the preliminaries, and you didn't have to take any tests, which is part I liked. but you could, in a sense, become a potter, or you could become a weaver, or you could become an art welder with, you know, maybe it was dangerous, but I mean, things happened. And in the art welding, at least one person, I don't know if you ever heard the name Dr. Ed LaChapelle. He was at the University of Washington. He was probably the premier expert on glaciers. I mean, this was again in the 70s and 80s. He's no longer living, but he taught there. And I happened to meet him at a avalanche school down at at White Pass, the Forest Service allowed me to register for this avalanche because we were, you know, asking them, you know, are we in danger up here for avalanches? And they said, yeah. So you better learn something about it. So anyway, I met Ed LaChapelle down there, and we invited him up here then, you know, on the faculty to talk about glaciers. And at that time, you know, avalanches weren't really studied at that time. They were just accepted. But about that time, all the ski areas were coming into business. And so the avalanches became a real economic item, too, and a safety item, too. So Ed LaChapelle became sort of the expert in the early years of the avalanche. But anyway, he came up to lecture, and his son Randy came with him, who was, I don't know, 14, 15 years old. He wasn't old enough to be on the volunteer staff at that time. But he learned arc welding from Terry. And then he came back on the staff and, you know, did more arc welding. And I'm not positive, but I heard that he then continued on with this and went into arc welding professionally, doing sculptures and so forth, and had a studio in Seattle. Now, I haven't verified that, but that's what I've been told. So, but I mean, it indicates what happens when you know, people come up here and they are exposed to something that excites their inner being, you know, whether it be, you know, their spiritual inner being or their art inner being or their whatever, you know, music inner being. And that I think is part of the uniqueness of Holden, is that it allowed people to come up here and be exposed to these things without, I mean, the younger people, if they were here on the volunteer staff, they didn't have any parents, so, you know, they didn't have to ask their parents, you know, if they could do this or if they had money to do it, because basically everything up here was, I mean, you could do arc welding at no cost. The metal was up there, and the welding equipment was at the garage, and nobody was going to charge them for that. And so that they, and same way with pottery. I think there was some minor charges sometimes for pottery and for weaving and so forth, but it was pretty minor. You know, so these things happened within community. Again, it's I think one of the unique things about Holden that continues on. Although I think, you know, maybe community has changed a little, not to criticize anything, but the more, again, controls and the more management control you have in a place, I think to a certain extent the innovation, you know, goes the other direction. And I think this is probably true in any research, you know, at a university. The more control there is over the research, the less innovative the person becomes. Because they're, you know, if you have to always document something, always report to a superior, get permission to do this, get permission to do that, you're not going to do the innovative things. And again, at Holden, and it was just that era in history, it was that time that, you know, when maybe out of our lack of understanding of how to begin an operation like this, that we didn't have any of those controls. We didn't have any of those limitations, so people could be, you know, very innovative and at basically no cost. The same way in the wood shop. In the early years, many people started making dulcimers. It was a very popular thing for a while up here, and other musical instruments. And, you know, in recent years, they cut I think it was a white pine tree that was then sent down to one of the guitar manufacturers. A very quality guitar was made from some of the white pine that came from here. But in those early years, I mean, we did have a sawmill, and we did cut lumber, and we did make dulcimers, and some other people made some other instruments. But and you know, then, you know, one person would bake them, and then somebody will say, can you teach us to do that? And so then the person who was innovative became the teacher for many others who were then became innovative and discovered that they had some natural ability to work with wood or to, you know, even work with music. So those are the things that I think, especially in the early years, were possible up here. And again, I'm not criticizing anything currently. It's just that when you're beginning an organization, and I'm sure all of you that have participated maybe in the beginning of a church or the beginning of another organization, that it's much easier at the beginning than it is, you know, 50 years later. That's just the way things go, and it's not a negative, but unfortunately it happens. So, but you know, we never should forget up here, no matter how long Holden lasts, is that Holden did begin with, in a sense, the destruction of the environment. And, you know, no matter what you think about mines or what you think about tailings or anything else, that's a fact of life. You know, we need copper, we need minerals and so forth, and there's going to be destruction of the environment, and got to live with it. And Holden became in existence because of that. And in some sense, we should, I don't know if you want to say rejoice or be thankful, but I mean, Holden isn't so pure that it came out of purity. You know, Holden came out of, in a sense, environmental destruction. And in a sense, Holden, you know, the mine and Holden also destroyed the community that used to exist in Railroad Creek Valley, which I think is, at least for me, is significant, that there was a community, a very small community in Railroad Creek Valley before Holden, before the mine got here, before Holden got here. And that was Oscar Getty down at Lucerne, who came up here as a pioneer, was able to, you know, actually own 3 acres of land down there because he had a mine claim, and he was able to get a patented claim on 3 acres, even though it never produced an ounce of ore. But he was a very clever guy and ended up with 3 acres, which is still down there as the Lake Chelan Boat Club. They have that 3 acres. And you know, and then Gordon Stewart came up to the Domke Lake really as a refuge out of the Forest Service, because he was a forest guard at Lucerne, and he was they were, right at that time the Forest Service was starting to use more college educated people as rangers and so forth, and Gordon lost his job because they wanted to hire somebody that had a college education, basically, and Gordon basically refused to leave, and he went to Domke Lake and lived there for 40 years all by himself. I mean, it's so sad, because you take people like Gordon Stewart, who had more knowledge than any college-educated person. I mean, you know, sort of street smart or canyon smart. I guess not street smart. There's no streets up here, but. He knew the forest, he knew the animals, he knew the mountains, he knew everything about the River Creek Valley that nobody else will ever know. And so that he was a part of the community along with Oscar Getty, and even though it was a community of two, the mine, in a sense, destroyed that, and Holden, in a sense, destroyed that. So I think it's necessary, you know, even for the future of Holden, to recognize that, you know, we think this is purity, we think this is spiritually, you know, at the top, and yet I think, you know, just in human life, there's, you know, we suffer, you know, there's a lot of things that don't go right in our lives and so forth, and we have to realize that, and even for Holden is not a pure, you know, place. It came out of destruction. People have been hurt here. People have, you know, been blessed here. You know, that's the way life is. And so I think that's you know, critical to keep that in mind. And I think that makes us honest, because I think the more honest we can be about our own lives or the, you know, the history of Holden, the more honest we can be, and the more innovative and the more spiritual we can be. I mentioned a little bit, I think, last night that part of the community was the volunteers that came up here, and part of that volunteer group was the retired group. And you take somebody like Horty Christman, who, if you didn't meet Horty Christman, you probably have heard his name, and he was another one of these people that was forest smart, or was outdoor smart, and was I think he finished the eighth grade, but he didn't go beyond the eighth grade as far as a formal education. But I have stated that he was a better engineer than I think any other engineer that ever came up here, because he could think through things, and he was the one that originally We salvaged a couple of beams out of the old mine. Actually, Gil Bird talked to the salvage company and let them come back an extra year if they would give us these big 36-inch beams, because Gil knew that the vehicle bridge needed replacing at some point. And those beams sat there for many years, and finally we decided we needed to do something. And we didn't have any equipment in these 36-inch beams. I mean, that's a big metal beam, you know, and it was, I don't know, 60 feet long, or I'm not sure, but it was long. I mean, it was enough to go across the creek. And they welded the superstructure to weld these two together, which made everything even more heavy. And Horty, I can remember one time he came up to me, he said, "Don't tell anybody where I'm going, because I'm going down there. I need to sit down there and look at this thing and figure out how we're going to do it." And so he went down there and sat. And, you know, a few days or a few weeks later, you know, the whole structure was being pulled across, and it worked. And another example for Horty was that we wanted to put an oil storage tank down at the diesel plants that were down here, and we wanted to use the storage not only for the diesel plants in the winter if we needed them, but also we then ran a line from there to in here, so that if we ran out of fuel here, we could pump it back into these tanks, then could be pumped around. And he found a 15,000 gallon tank up at the mine. It was partially submerged or buried. The mine used it. Still had some oil in it. He did the same thing. He, you know, again, we had no equipment. The bomb truck was the only thing we had, and the flatbed truck. And he decided, well, the only way we're going to get that out of the ground is if we float it. So he took the fire hose and basically filled a hole where the tank was located to pop it out of the ground, and it worked. I mean, it's logic once you think of it, but it takes a guy like Horty or another clever engineer, you know, to think about those things. And once it was popped out of the ground, then it was, I think they used the bomb truck. I don't remember. We did get a bigger crane at one point, but they put it on the flatbed truck, and he said, you know, we don't have any option of adjusting this in the hole once we get it down at the diesel plant, because the fill spout has to be vertical up, not down, and it can't be, you know, buried. And so he figured out how to put it on the truck and then to roll it off on timbers and roll it in the hole so that the standpipe and the fill spout would be vertical. And it worked. And this was Horty. He was the one that, you know, his picture is in the museum display there. I noticed it, and they have a little sign there that his very famous comment was, "If you understood this place, you would ruin it." And I think that's the point of community is the more you study community, the more you destroy it. I think. Yeah, I don't know, maybe intellectually that doesn't make any sense, but I do think that community sort of has to happen. And this was a unique place because Holden Village didn't have a history. The mine had a history, Gordon and Oscar had a history, but Holden Village didn't have a history, so that we could start fresh and we could make mistakes, and we did make mistakes. And we could learn, and we did learn. And other people like Horty came up here and shared his wisdom that he learned. He was, after he got out of the eighth grade, he became a professional barber and actually was a barber in Chelan for a while. And, you know, again, was one of these marvelous people that Holden was privileged to have. And I'm not sure Holden would be here if it wouldn't be for Horty. But people like that came up here. There was, you know, the Holden Bell up here that's in the coffee circle, or I guess it's the Ark now. That came from the Great Northern Railroad. Gil Berg had a very good friend that was in Seattle in management with Great Northern, and then he was transferred to Minneapolis, where I think Great Northern had their main headquarters. Anyway, Gil, and I think it was the late 50s, even before Holden was totally here, maybe it was after 61 when they knew that something was going to be here anyway. Gil contacted his friend, and because those bells were very popular collectors, you know, as steam engines were being dismantled and taken out of service, those bells were worth a lot of money. And this friend of Gil's responded to Gil and gave him one of these bells for Holden Village, and that's how Holden ended up with the bell that's up there now. But you know, and again, you know, people like Gil, he was only in a sense involved directly with Holden for a very short time, but his impact on Holden was tremendous. And without Gil, I don't know. I mean, he had an oil distributor business, so he had some money. He could take some time off. His son-in-law was starting to run the business, and he was willing to put his own money and his own efforts in here. And he knew a lot of people, and he had, I would say he was a good salesman, because he could really make the close on, if he saw somebody that he thought needed to be up here, he would convince them that they needed to be up here or they needed to give something. And one of the examples, we'll talk a little bit more about that tonight, is the Hyder plant. And the Sheffels, who live in Wilbur, Washington, I think the son, Jerry Sheffels, is still alive. And Gil met them, and they were very wealthy. They had wheat lands in eastern Washington as well as Montana. Jerry flew his own plane so they could get to the Montana site. And in fact, he landed up here on the tailings one time. But Gil recognized that, got acquainted with them, and got them involved in Holden. The Sheffels found the Hydro plant sitting over in Idaho that had been sitting there for 20 years, and they bought it for either $1,200 or $1,500, and then gave it to Holden, and that's what Holden has now been using for 56 years. It's been updated and improved, but basically that same equipment is what the Sheffels gave that Gil Bird knew was, I mean, he knew they were a special place. In fact, the Sheffels also gave the bomb truck, which allowed a lot of things to go on around here, including the extension of the pipeline and the new diversion dam and so forth. They gave that to Holden Village. And they gave the first real bus. It was a 10 or 12 passenger 40 Econoline. Was the first sort of transportation that Holden had, and the Sheffels gave that to Holden. So you know, people like that and like Gil Bird were critical to the beginning of this place, that again no committee or nobody could sort of plan out ahead of time. And I think the other thing that happened about that time, and Carol became director and arrived in the village in June of 1963. That was the summer that I came up here as a volunteer. And I right away, when Gil arrived, you know, it was very evident that there was a tension between Carol and Gil. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it, and, you know, I wasn't going to get involved in it. I was a volunteer and I was working in the kitchen. But it really was a sort of an intense a time between Gil and Carol. And the reason for it, I mean, just looking back at it and thinking about it, is that Carol, you know, was so concerned about the program, and he saw Holden, rightly so, as the reason for its existence should be the program. It should not be the facilities. And I think Carol was concerned that with this facility and all the infrastructure that was necessary and so forth, and I think the main thing was that Carol saw that everybody that was associated with Holden at the time, everybody that was associated with Holden at the time was dealing with facilities, and which was natural, because when Gil came up here, you know, the water didn't work, nothing worked, there was no power, the buildings were unlivable, and so naturally the first thing that needs to be done is the facilities needs to be updated and made livable, right? Because you can't invite people up here, or you can't have a program, you know, if you don't have a facility. And I don't think Gil ever I mean, in a sense, Gil was a very quiet person, at least in public, and you never, at least I never saw him get, you know, angry or upset and so forth. But Carol had a real tension with Gil for that reason, that he identified as Gil as the facility person, and since everybody here was dealing with facilities, that in a sense Carol didn't have any control. He didn't have many program people up here. And it was, the more I thought of it over the years, I think it was an excellent tension. And, you know, Carol was right. I always felt sad that Gil became sort of, that I don't think Carol ever appreciated Gil to the extent that he should have. But I think Carol was right that Holden needs to be programmed. And the reason that Holden should exist is for program. And for community, you need sort of the combination of program and facilities. And it doesn't mean that facilities can't be important, but if program isn't the primary thing that takes place up here, then what do you have? You have a facility or a resort or, you know, a nice place in the mountains that's well taken care of, but it's the program that should make Holden special, and it has made Holden special. And that goes back to another thing that I remember Carol saying one day. I don't know if some of you remember the old One magazine. It was a publication of the American Lutheran Church, and it was designed for youth. You know, they had the Lutheran Standard for the adults, and so they wanted something for youth. And they started the One magazine, and it was not successful. And I remember getting the One magazine and paging through it because my father was a pastor, and I thought I probably should page through it. But it was not a good magazine, you know. And at one point, the church decided they would have to decide they needed to subsidize One magazine because it wasn't taking enough money and so forth. And so Carol got a letter from the youth department saying that we could no longer subsidize Holden Village at the rate of, I don't remember, $7,500 a year, because we need to put that money into One magazine. And I can remember that Carol stomped into my office, and I mean, he was just livid, and he said, "One of these days, the church is going to find me laying down with a note pinned on my, you know, I'm going to be dead, and there's going to be a note pinned on my shirt that why did they support a failing magazine instead of Holden Village?" And then I think it was about the same time that Carol made the comment again, which I didn't understand initially, but I totally agree with him. And I think he was wise in making the statement, was that he said, and maybe it was in connection with this thing with the finances, but he said, I hope as soon as the Holy Spirit is done with Holden Village, that Holden Village will die a quick death. And, you know, I was really almost offended by that when he first said it, because he just said it personally to me, and, you know, I just didn't understand it. But the more I've thought about it, you know, again, I think he was brilliant. I think he was right, that because, again, going back to what his concept was, that the program at Holden was what should be what Holden is here for and not the facilities. And I think in some ways that Carol would have a difficult time being here now, because I think the facility, the work in the facility has almost taken over. Again, I mean, I'm not criticizing, but just an observation. And it's a huge facility and a very important facility, and it takes a lot of care and it takes a lot of work to keep it going. But, you know, right now, if you think about it, you know, how much effort is being given to the facility over against how much effort is being given to the program? And I'm not sure. I haven't been up here very long, but I guess I would worry that maybe, you know, Carol's fear is, you know, is sort of manifested itself here, that maybe the program is important, but maybe the facility has gotten so big and so complicated to operate that that's become more important than the program. And again, I apologize if I offend anybody, but that's just an observation. There are a lot of, you know, sort of funny things that have happened, which I think also helped create community, getting back to community. And one of them was that one time I was down lake, I went down frequently with my own boat to to do business trips for Holden and shopping and so forth, and I came back to 25 Mile. This was before Field Point was there, and maybe some of you remember that everybody parked on the road between the Forest Service house and, you know, just up the hill, and that was the only parking there was there for people getting on the boat at 25 Mile. And I walked up, because at that time Holden already had purchased the little orchard that now is where the bed and breakfast is, and I saw a car in line with all the other cars, and it was all wet around there, and it just didn't make any sense to me. And it was the car had been flattened down to about a foot, and I went down to the ranger station. There was still, at that time, there was a ranger there all summer long, and I asked him, well, you know, what happened? I was just curious. And he sort of started chuckling. He said, well, I think it's somebody from Holden. And there was a fire up the valley, and they were dipping water out of the lake. And this big water bucket that they dipped out of the lake, and I can't remember how many gallons, but it was probably several tons of water that they were taking up, and it fell, and it hit this car, and it didn't damage the one in back, or it didn't damage the one in front, and it just damaged the car itself. Yeah, it was humorous, but it was sad. And, you know, so he gave me the license plate number of it, and when I went back up late in the evening, I remember they were having a picnic, and I sort of walked around and said, you know, does anybody own a VW Rabbit with the license plate so-and-so? And this one young couple, said, yeah, that's ours. And I said, well, there's been an accident. And, you know, I explained what had happened, and they were, you know, they were good about it. I mean, there was nothing they could do. And I said, but the Forest Ranger wanted me to specifically tell you that he salvaged the radio out of it because it looked like that survived. and they said, they started laughing, and they said, well, that's ironic because that's the only thing that didn't work on it. And there was a... And later on, this couple sent an article, and maybe they still do. I don't have a VW, but VW puts out a little magazine. This was in the, I guess, in the late 70s. And so that this couple wrote an article about this incident for, and it was in the national or in the international magazine that VW puts out. And the title was, Roy Rogers Shoots Rabbit. And it turns out that the helicopter pilot, his name was Roy Rogers. So that's, you know, one of the many things that, you know, it's not important, but it's an interesting story, I think, of what happens when people, you know, come up here. In terms of community, again, there were, you know, we were in the drug age. Now we're legally in the drug age in Washington State, I guess, although I don't live here anymore. And I've never tried marijuana. but at that time it was still new, and it was illegal, and it was, you know, the hippie generation. And you probably remember that in 1967, it was called the Summer of Love down in Haight-Ashbury. That's when Haight-Ashbury down in San Francisco got its notoriety. And so naturally there were, you know, students, you know, from that same era and that were up here, and they would bring marijuana. In fact, there were faculty members. I remember specifically that it wasn't just the volunteers, it was faculty. Some, not many, but I mean, there were a few faculty that had marijuana with it. And so that was always sort of an underlying thing that we dealt with. I mean, it was illegal. We didn't want it used up here. I still can't detect marijuana odor. Everybody else can, but I can't. But I mean, I flushed a number of things down the toilet over the years, and maybe that's what ruined the sewer system. I don't know. but you know, we dealt with it in various ways. And one winter, I would ride the boat up and down the lake, and some people were always concerned about Holden Village. Something illegal must be going on up here because everybody seems so happy, you know. And so that the word started coming up the lake that there was a big marijuana activity up here, and people were selling it and distributing it and so forth. And, you know, how do you find out about these things? I mean, you can't ask. I mean, if you ask people, nobody's going to admit it. And so I went down to the sheriff's department in Wenatchee, and I just said, you know, have any suggestions? And he said, well, we'd heard a little bit about Holden Village and marijuana, but, you know, he said, we've got a undercover person that works with the sheriff's department, and it's a young couple, and they have a young child, I think it was like less than a year old, and he said, you know, how about if they come up on the volunteer staff and then just live in the community and see once what they say. And so, you know, nobody else knew. In fact, I think until fairly recently that I didn't even relate this story to anybody, including, I don't think Carol knew about it even at that time. And anyway, so they came up. The problem was that they arrived on Saturday. There was no boat. The sheriff's department brought them up late. I picked them up down there. So I think, you know, some people in the community couldn't figure out why they got special attention. But anyway, they lived in the community for, I think it was 2 weeks. They were supposed to be here for 3 weeks because that was our minimum. And at the end of 2 weeks, they came up to me and said, you know, you don't have any problem here. There's a few people using marijuana, but, you know, don't worry about it. It's you know, nothing to worry about. So they went down. They were a wonderful couple. And I did hear several years later that the husband actually was killed. He was doing undercover work for another sheriff's department, and he was apparently killed because of some investigation work. But they fit beautifully into the community. And, you know, and again, they said, then a few years later, when Fritz Norstedt was here, it came up again in the community, and like a larger number of the students were using it. And Fritz had a way of dealing with things that, he was a professional. He was a pastor. He was a psychologist and a very loving person. And I remember one night after Vespers right in here, he said, word's going around that some people in the village are using marijuana, and you know that that's against the law for staff. It was during the winter. We were still using, or maybe it was in early spring. But anyway, that he said, anybody that's used marijuana, just be on the bus tomorrow. And you can be out of the village 1 month, and if you want to come back, you're welcome to come back. But stay out and think about it, what it means to be in community. And think about it, you know, that there are some rules in community, and this is one of our rules. And that's all he said. There was never any acquisition on any individual. The next day, about 14 people got on the bus. it worked. And I think only one person came back after the 30 days, and it so happens that person then, I think was facility manager up here for a period of time, and now he's over on the coast at a facility that's operated on, what is it, Lake Diablo? Is it Diablo or is that Diablo Lake? Diablo. It's an environmental center. Anyway, I mean, so that Fritz's approach to dealing with marijuana and community, you know, really worked. And that's the other thing that how community works is that if you're going to make so many rules and accuse people and so forth, that you may not have community, but if you're a Fritz Norstedt and can just say, you know, okay, we've got rules. If you want to be a part of community, leave and think about it and come back. And then you're welcome to come back. And so I think Holden over the years has been able to enjoy community and be a part of it, without destroying people. I mean, I think a lot of young people came up here. They spread their wings. They said things that they never would be able to do to their parents or to their church or to their school. They argued with professors that they never would be able to without getting a failing grade. And they learned from it. And they became some of the great people that we have now in society and in the church. So community is important, but even Holden, I don't think, can create community. It really has to be something that develops very naturally when you're not scared of taking chances. So any comments or anybody want to add anything? Or?
I I have a question. Who is Dan?
Who is what?
Dan's camp.
Oh, that I don't know. I never did hear. I mean, I was curious about that, and I don't think that if I found out, I've forgotten. It was probably at the top of Dan's camp, you know, during the early days of the mine before the switchbacks were put in, they had a tramway. In fact, I think you can still see the vegetation is different. There's a line that goes from the end of the dock up the hill.
Right.
And that was a tramway, and at the top was the landing for the tramway, and that's how they got all their freight and so forth up there. And it could be that maybe Dan was the operator of the tram. I don't know. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. So. Oh, the one thing that I thought of that was that some of the interesting people that have come to Holden in those early years, and I mentioned Stan Borison, who was the TV personality, but Ruth Carter Stapleton. I don't know if you've heard of her. She was President Carter's sister, and she was here with that CFO group, the Camp Farthest Out, and she was a preacher, lecturer, evangelist with the Camp Farthest Out, so she was here for a week. Al Cui, who was governor of Minnesota, spent time here. In fact, his son was on the volunteer staff, and he came up here. I can't remember if he was the governor at the time, maybe not, but he had been governor. And Senator Paul Simon from Illinois was a famous senator that he was also here on faculty. And Rudy Wendland, who you probably recognize, he was the creator of Smokey Bear. And he did the original drawing of Smokey Bear when he was with the Forest Service back in Washington, D.C. And I think he was in the same congregation as John and Murray Schrammer. They knew him so that they had some contact. He was a Lutheran. And so he was here and did a lot of drawings when he was here, and even did some that, yeah.
Can you repeat that last name? Rudy what?
Wendland. It's, let's see, it's W-E-N-D-E-L-I-N, Wendland.
Okay.
And then Willie Unsell, who was the first climber of Mount Everest on the West Ridge that had never been climbed before. He and his wife Jolene came through here and spent a few days here and shared stories and so forth. And Jolene later, Willie Unsell died on Mount Rainier a few years later in a climbing accident, but his wife continued on working in environment and then was congressman from Washington State for a number of years. I think she's still living, but and then of course, I mean, there were a lot of other people, some theologians from Europe that were here for various conferences. Dr. Schutz, who was the president of the old, I think it was the ALC, and for his final farewell time when he retired as bishop, he brought all the bishops from the whole church up here, and which is an interesting story too, because it was the one of the times when the village was closed down because of forest fires. And I got a lot of the bishops were already on their way here, and I got notice from the Forest Service that Holden was closed and we could maintain enough people here to protect the facility, but everybody else had to leave. And I went down right away and talked to the ranger and said, we've got a PR problem. And you know, the ranger at first said, you know, we can't make any exceptions. And I said, well, there, you know, some of them are, you know, on their way out. Some of them are actually in Chelan right now. And these are the main people in the church, the bishops. They're important people. And Holden was, I mean, at that time, Holden was looking for opportunities for making sure that everybody knew about Holden. And I said, you know, you did tell us that we could maintain enough staff to protect the place. You know, could we officially put the bishops on our staff for the 5 days or 6 days? And he said, yeah, that shouldn't be a problem. So he was nice enough to go along with it. And so they got up here, and Dr. Schutz, who was the main bishop, he said that, I mean, he was just being honest, and he told the other bishops that officially they were on staff up here. And I can remember one bishop, I think he was from the Ohio Synod, that said, this isn't right, this is a lie, this is deceiving, and we can't do this. This is against our very nature. And he said, I demand a vote by raising of hands so everybody will know who's for and who's against this. And so Dr. Schutz had this vote, and only one person raised his hand. All the others wanted to stay, so they were here for the 5 or 6 days. And of course, the village wasn't threatened by fire, but it was, you know, in the area, it was nothing like a couple of years ago here. So, but it was interesting that
at least,
yeah. Well, he stayed. He stayed, and he probably enjoyed it. And, pardon?
As on staff, then he didn't have to do any work.
Well, none of them had to do any work because we didn't have a fire, but officially they were on staff. So.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. Tonight at 6 o'clock, I'll do one on some of the projects that the village was involved, which is very interesting, and we had a lot of interesting projects, so it's sort of a fun thing. And then tomorrow morning at 11, I'm going to do one actually that I hadn't done before, is you know, how Holden has changed over 56 years. And I think it's just interesting to sort of go over, and I'll probably say some of the same things I've said and some of the other things, but, you know, organizations change, times change, and, you know, the village has changed. And again, we have to celebrate it and do the best we can, so. Also, a lot of these stories that I've shared are in the book that I wrote. It's called Holden Village, A Memoir. And right now it doesn't happen to be in the bookstore. I'm not sure why, if they're out of it or if they've condemned it. But you can get it on Amazon. It's on Amazon either by in the Kindle version or the regular book. You can still order it on Amazon. So if you're interested, you can go on Amazon and get it. And if you're Prime, you get it in 2 days. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.